From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour begins with a simple device, our cell phones. Perhaps we're using it right now to listen to this broadcast. We tend to guard our cell phone as if it's an extension of our own bodies. In fact, we are more likely to put a case on our cell phones than we are to wear a helmet on our heads. So here's an interesting idea. Would you be willing to donate part of your cell phone to research? What if you allowed your cell phone to be turned over to scientific study while you sleep? It's not a hypothetical question anymore. We're going to explain exactly how that works today as part of our first ever Science Roundtable on Connections. Now, throughout the hour, we will talk about a number of issues in the news and also issues under examination by researchers at the University of Rochester. Joining us for this month's panel are Dr. Wendy Heinzelman, who is a professor of electrical and computer engineering and the dean of graduate studies. Nice having you here.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Dr. Jody Manley is the clinical director at the Mount Hope Family Center and research associate in the Department of Psychology. Nice to see you.
Thanks for having me.
And Dr. Bob Beckman is a professor of chemistry specializing in organic chemistry and also the associate editor for the Journal of Organic Chemistry. Dr. Beckman, nice to have you here.
Nice to be here.
Well, I want to start by saying, by the way, that if I go back to my college days, it's fascinating that the first Science Roundtable would have someone with a specialization in organic chemistry, because this was my connection to organic chemistry in college. I was a sophomore in college, and I was dating the woman who would become my wife, and she was taking organic chemistry. So she would be up into the late hours at Sargent Hall at Ohio University studying organic chemistry. Now, I was also up into the late hours. I was studying journalism, so I was playing euchre. That was the difference between the two of us. And she would come by and see another great euchre battle going on, and she would frown and say, back to O-Chem, I believe was the shorthand, Dr. Beckman. O-Chem, right?
Well, it varies, also called Orgo.
But I make light of the fact that my scientific background is not nearly as strong as my wife's or many people. I married much higher and smarter than myself. But I've always had a fascination and love for science. I think it's more important than ever that this country embrace and really kind of dig into the fascinating research that's going on. And so in this room today with Dr. Beckman, Dr. Heinzelman, and Dr. Manley are some wonderful research components of going on here in Rochester. So we're going to talk about a lot of different things. I chose to start on this idea of donating our cell phones. And so, Dr. Heinzelman, it sounds like, you know, convincing anybody to give up their cell phone to research purposes is probably a little concerning. But why don't we start by talking about what's actually happening?
Sure. So we developed a distributed computing platform that we call GemCloud. And the idea behind GemCloud is that there's just millions and millions of cell phones that are going idle when people sleep, when they're busy doing other things. And unlike personal computers or even laptops, people don't tend to ever turn their cell phones off. So when they're idle, when they're plugged in, they're still on, they're able to compute, but they're just not being used for anything at the particular moment. So we did some studies and found that the energy efficiency of cell phones has gotten to be so good, and the power of cell phones is really incredible. I mean, cell phones today, the latest Nexus 7 smart tablets and cell phones are as powerful as a laptop from about 2 years ago in terms of the compute power that they can provide. So there's so much power in the cell phones, and they're so energy efficient that if you took a very large computing task and gave it to a really intense server somewhere, an Amazon web server in the cloud somewhere, it's much more energy efficient to take that same task and run it over lots and lots of different cell phones. They can't each do the entire thing, but we can give pieces of the job to each individual cell phone. They can run those pieces, and we can kind of put everything back together and get our result. And the energy cost is much better using cell phones than using those big servers because of all the heating costs and the actual power that they draw. So it's a much more energy efficient platform. So we developed this approach where you can decide how to use this platform. So you specify you can use my cell phone when it's plugged in, but never when it's on battery. You can use my data connection if I'm on Wi-Fi, but never 3G. Or maybe you can use 3G. If I have unlimited data plan, I don't mind using 3G connection and having you use some of my data plan. So you can use my cell phone when I'm not on the phone or when I'm not doing something else with it. So you as a user can specify how to interact with the system.
And let me just back up for you. So as the user, if you agree to kind of get involved, you can set some of the parameters. Even can you do time of day?
Yes, absolutely. You can specify exactly what you want and how you want this to interact with your cell phone in particular. So once you set it up, then the idea is you should never notice it's there. So you set it up to only work when I'm plugged in, for example. So when I come home at night, I put my phone into the charger and I leave it and I never touch it again. It's running all these compute cycles. And so it's participating in solving some really complex scientific problems while it's just sitting there.
I would ask you what kind of complex scientific problems. I have no idea if I would understand it, but why don't we at least take a stab at it?
Sure. So what we actually have a study going on right now where we're using the system, and we asked volunteers to put this system called GemCloud on their Android devices, and they're running computations. It's an algorithm called SAINT2 that basically tries to understand how proteins fold and how proteins, how the atoms in proteins are organized with each other. And the basic idea of the algorithm is the better you can understand the structure of proteins, the better you can make drugs that can fight diseases or combat certain issues that happen with the proteins. So the unique thing about this algorithm is that you give each individual cell phone runs the algorithm with a different random starting point, and they all come to a concluding point. And the more of these answers you get, the more likely it is you're to find the right one, the best answer. And so the more cell phones that participate in this type of study, the better results you're going to get overall.
How long have you been doing it?
The study began in October. So what's that, about 3-4 months now.
And how much participation have you achieved?
We have had 125 participants who started. So we asked them to take a pre-survey to ask them their opinions about distributed computing. Right now in our study, we pay participants. We pay them $20 Amazon gift card to participate in the study. And we ask them information about, would you participate if you're paid? Would you participate if you know that you're saving energy because these computations are being done on energy efficient devices versus big servers? Would you participate if you knew you were helping science? So you were solving problems related to climate change or helping to find a cure for cancer. What would be your motivation for trying to participate? Then we have them participate in the study. They download the GemCloud application, run it for a month, and then we give them a post-survey and ask them, what was your thoughts about running the GemCloud application? Did you ever notice it was there? Did you interact with it? Because you can choose to interact with it if you want, and we get lots of information from that. So 125 people participated in that study, and then about another 50 have just downloaded on their own the application and run it. And it's from all over the world. We actually have participants mostly from the Rochester area because that's where we advertise the study. But as far away as India and I think Japan, we have a few participants, Europe.
I haven't even mentioned that. Roger is engineering for me today. Roger, I didn't even mention the phone number. Why are the phones ringing? I mean, that's great. People must really be interested in the Science Roundtable. I don't think I meant to the phone, but if you do want to weigh in on this subject or any others throughout the hour, 263-WXXI, 263-9994. Now, I'm going to assume that those who are calling now want to weigh in on what Dr. Heinzelman's talking about, so let's take a stab and let's bring in Paul in Rochester. Paul, thanks for calling.
Good afternoon. Welcome to everyone. Curious question, try to do it quickly for you. On Saturday, NPR, at the beginning of a premiere of an opera, lost their satellite signal to a solar storm. All this new research technology is absolutely marvelous. I get a lot of it done in my medical test. But my question is, those satellites that contribute an enormous amount of this, how vulnerable are they up there? Everybody's excited about their cell phones, computers, and on, but are they really, really aware of just how delicate those satellites are that are carrying that information?
Fair question. Can you speak to it, Dr. Heinzelman?
Most of the time, cellular communication does not involve satellite communication. So usually when you're on your cell phone, you're talking to the local cell tower, and those tend to be connected by fiber optic cable back to the main network. So in terms of cell phones, there's not a huge connection to satellite telephony. I don't know too much about, you know, how things are done here at WXXI and what kind of satellites are being used. There's a lot of redundancy, so there's numerous satellites because as they move, whether they're geostationary or mobile, there's redundancy so that you do have less of that, but of course there's still going to be issues that are going to come
up. Just a quick question. They had a conference roughly about 3 years ago in Washington on, oddly enough, it's not a cell phone, but on the electrical grids. And this was also based on, you can go into a government website for, space weather, it's called, and you can get a great, great background on it. But they had a conference because in the event of a solar storm hitting one of our electrical grids, if they go down, it could take up to a year or more to replace them. And although the cell phone is not, the tower itself could be affected.
Sure, of course.
Through magnetic radiation.
Yep, absolutely.
Thank you for your information.
Yeah, thanks very much for the call and the interest. Let's get Bernard in Fairport. Go ahead, Bernard.
Thank you, and I appreciate this Science Hour. I think it's a great idea. And I would appreciate some comments from your speakers as you go through these programs about the place of science in our society. My belief is that it's kind of fallen behind the curve. Now, I was raised in the 60s, and everybody wanted to be a scientist. I don't think that's true anymore, but I'd be interested in comments. And regarding this distributed computing process on cell phones, we tried this stuff over the last couple of decades with just laptops and desktops. And one of the things that we found was that people were very afraid, I guess is the term, about letting somebody basically get into their computer. I mean, today that's malware, and I'd be interested in how they're going to approach that social problem, given the fact that, you know, there's certainly plenty going on in terms of stealing information, as well as, again, back to the point, is science credible enough to get access to my cell phone and private data? Thanks very much.
Thanks, Bernard.
Yeah, so I can address the second question in terms of the security of these types of applications. And I would say, on the one hand, you're right that people are very leery, or some people are very leery about applications on their cell phones. But on the other hand, the generation of young people who are coming up are so used to downloading apps that do lots of things on their cell phones, and they actually really don't know what kind of information is being transmitted and what they're using. So I think there is a class of people who care very much, and I think more people should care because people really don't know what's being put on their cell phones and what access it has to their cell phones. So I would say in terms of the security and privacy issues in terms of the program or the distributed computing platform GemCloud that we created, we use the Android platform, which provides some inherent security where you can't access certain features of the cell phone. Android does that automatically for you to give you one layer of protection. So anything that is able to run on the Android platform through the Google Play Store, once you've uploaded it and everything's checked out, you have some level of security. It's not perfect, that it's not going to kind of eat up your cell phone and ruin your ability to use your cell phone as the device that you intended it for. We also do not capture any kind of location information. We really would like to know GPS information, but we don't capture GPS information. We do capture IP information where you actually access the network from in an IP sense. From cellular, if you're accessing 3G, 4G, we actually don't have any information about where you are. So we don't capture GPS information, which would be very helpful, but because of privacy considerations, we don't capture that. Many applications that people put on their cell phones these days do capture that and transmit it, and people just are not aware of that.
We're talking about a number of issues in our science community with our first ever Science Roundtable on Connections here during this hour with Dr. Wendy Heintzelman, who is talking about this rather new idea of donating some of our part of our cell phones for scientific research. Dr. Bob Beckman is a professor of chemistry and also the associate editor for the Journal of Organic Chemistry. And Dr. Jody Todd Manley is here. And we're going to be talking about some of her research when it comes to building healthy children. And also we're going to spend just a couple minutes talking about an article that kind of went viral last week about whether babies can learn to read. So there's so much we're going to get to this hour. Let's wrap up this little portion of the discussion that by saying, Wendy, that if anybody just joined us, how can, if they're interested and say, hey, I'd love to donate my cell phone for research, I think it's a nice idea, how do they do it?
If you go to the Google Play Store and just look up GemCloud, GemCloud, you'll find our application and you can download it and start participating.
Do you think it's part of the future of scientific research?
I do think it's not going to be the only way computations are going to be done, because one of the things that's required for this to be successful is you have to have an algorithm that's highly parallelizable. If something is serial, meaning that I start from the beginning and I need the results of the first section to go on to the second section and then so forth, if it's highly serial, if it's a serial type of algorithm, you can't distribute it over multiple platforms. The way this works is for any algorithm that you can give independent pieces to lots and lots of devices, have them compute the result and give it back to you. I do think that people are going to be very interested in this, especially if there's any kind of financial model associated with this. So you get paid $20 like you did in our study to just have your cell phone not doing anything, you know, be doing this computing when you're not doing anything on it. It's actually a nice model for people to afford their cell phones.
This will be a fun project to kind of recircle and visit with as it goes forward, to see how many more people get on board. Very interesting stuff. 263-WXXI, 263-9994 to join the conversation in the Science Roundtable. Dr. Bob Beckman has been consulted by a number of people just asking a basic question that has been in the news for weeks now, which is, what's in the water in West Virginia? And having lived and worked there myself, Dr. Beckman, there are a lot of concerns, environmental concerns, about the coal and chemical industries. It's kind of known as the Chemical Valley there in the Kanawha Valley. What can you tell us so far about what we know about what's been happening in the water in West Virginia, and particularly in light of the area around Charleston and the Kanawha Valley?
Well, the incident began with a leak from a containment vessel which contained methyl cyclohexane methanol, which is a material that's used as a solvent in the process of cleaning coal for use in various plants. And so this material leaked into the river, which the vessel had a containment area built around it, as it's required to by law, but that containment area failed to contain all of the material, and about 10,000 gallons of this material managed to get into the river, which was adjacent to the tank. Material has been tested in animals and been found to be relatively non-toxic. By that I mean it didn't show any acute toxic effects when tested on animals. It did have some level of toxicity to aquatic organisms, and all these results were looked at, but it had never been tested in higher mammals or man. Now, typically, we in the toxicology business, the use of animal testing to verify the toxicity of something has pretty good history of being predictive of the effects in man. Now, that doesn't mean that there aren't some minor effects that do occur. For example, it was found to be a minor irritant and could cause some digestive problems. But when you consider that it went into a river which has a volume of water flowing through it, this 10,000 gallons of material, while it sounds like a large amount of material, is rapidly diluted. And one of the things that you can count on in terms of toxicity is the issue of what is called the biological threshold, meaning that even if a material shows toxicity in high concentrations, at some concentration, dependent on the chemical, it will no longer elicit a biological effect. And so the process of dilution of this material but with water rapidly reduced the hazard. So the hazard was greatest in the immediate vicinity mm-hmm. of the tank, and given the knowledge of the flow of water through there, I saw a calculation done by the people in the Department of Environmental Protection in West Virginia that indicated that the dilution was pretty rapid. And by their calculations, the amount of material per liter of water, it would have, and I did some calculations when I was asked to do this by another media person, they found that this material was sufficiently dilute that a male would have had to drunk something like 22 liters of water in order to ingest a toxic amount of it.
Can we at least define what we mean by the word toxic?
Well,
because people hear toxic, they think fatal.
Toxicity means it elicits a biological effect. Toxicity is judged in terms of what is called 50% of the lethal dose, or the LD50. The lethal dose of this, in a rat, not in a human being, was determined to be several grams, which is a substantial amount of material to have ingested.
Mm-hmm.
The LD50, of course, in man is going to be different. We don't know precisely what it will be, but again, based on the history of testing, one presumes that that man has better mechanisms than a rodent to take care of these xenobiotic materials, and so the presumption is that this would be substantially less, although again there was no direct testing done. But the key is that the dilution was sufficient that there would not have been sufficient amount of material unless you ingested a huge amount of water to reach a toxic level.
And they talked about the water impacting 300,000 West Virginians, essentially told, don't use the water for a while. The company and the industry has been saying, we're getting this under control. Greenpeace was there making a video. And if we could, I just want to listen to a couple of the comments from a man and a woman in this video put together by Greenpeace of people who said they had kind of experienced firsthand the impact of this spill. Let's listen.
I got in it, took a shower 3 days after we drained our system, where I have open cuts and sores, where I'm a mechanic by trade. It made me deaf sick. I had severe diarrhea. My kids have been the same way. They've snuck and got into it. They've got deaf sick. It's just been unreal.
The smell from the water was incredibly intense. I experienced skin irritations and rashes.
And now they're saying we're still good, but we're not good in our water. We're still having to reach out and ask for help to get water into us because of the chemicals still there. It's not gone.
So, as you said, Dr. Beckman, it's diluted to in some way. Maybe the folks in this video are the people most immediately impacted, but at least by now it seems to have dissipated to the point where there shouldn't be a concern?
Certainly, yes, unless the water was contained in a tank,
right.
It should have dissipated sufficiently diluted that it would have reduced below any threshold for biological or toxicological activity. However, the material is volatile relative to water, so that what the people were experiencing was the vapor of the material coming out of the water. That will certainly happen if you, for example, had contaminated water that you put in your hot water tank,
mm-hmm.
and you heated it up and then you used it to shower. That water would issue the vapor of this material from it because it would be volatilized by the heating process. And so the fact is that they could have been exposed to a significant amount of it if they managed to get contaminated water into their house system. In general, however, and by the way, the lady's comments about the skin irritation, that is consistent with the known toxicological effects of the material.
That is consistent.
It is consistent. It is known to be a skin irritant. It will vary. Of course, human beings vary in their sensitivity
sure.
to things. So there can be very susceptible people and not so susceptible people. However, in any of these kinds of chemical spills, my experience is that the human mind has the ability to create hysteria.
Yes.
And so people can, if they believe they're in there is a concern, they can manufacture it, shall we say. Now, I'm not saying that's the case in the instance of the people who who were interviewed by Greenpeace. But the fact of the matter is that there are many, many cases where it's been demonstrated scientifically that there were no hazard, and yet the population experienced the symptoms, and they were real. And so the fact of the matter is that some of this can be attributed to just that kind of a hysterical effect.
Are you saying the correlation is not always causation?
I'm saying that you know, the placebo effect in the reverse sense can work very strongly.
Sure. And one more quick question on this subject with Dr. Beckman, who is a professor of chemistry at the University of Rochester. In the immediate days following the spill in West Virginia, there were questions about what's in the material, what's in the chemicals, how much, you know, and we start hearing about measurements, parts per million, et cetera, needs to be in a given set of water that would create a hazard or toxicity. And for at least some period of time, the answer we kept getting was, we don't know. And your job is not to set a policy prescription. Your job is to talk about the science. But was there any set of surprise that there was at least the company wasn't immediately ready to say, we know exactly what's in it, we know what to do about it?
Well, they certainly knew what the chemical was, and they knew the purity of it. And they had tested the material, which had, you know, maybe not that specific batch that was in that tank, but the manufacturer of that material had tested it, knew what the impurities were that were in it, knew what purity it was, and had taken the raw material and tested it in these toxicological tests. So certainly they knew the amounts of material which would have affected an animal. They obviously, since no testing had been done on human beings, they couldn't say with absolute certainty what the effects would be on human beings. They could only go on the general correlation that has been used historically in testing for toxicity, in judging the relative toxicity between testing on a particular animal species and man. And again, there's huge variability even among human beings. So you cannot guarantee 100% that even within a population of a city that you won't have very susceptible human beings that will suffer ill effects from what for the majority would not be an issue at all. And so you have, there is no question that the whole ability to know this with certainty is difficult, especially since you don't know precisely the concentration. Without testing the samples that these people interacted with, you wouldn't be able to know with any certainty what actually was there, and then make a judgment about whether it could or might have been toxic.
Here's what we're going to do next here. We're going to get into the subject of building healthy children, looking at what Dr. Jody Todd-Manley has been working on, and also talking about an article that went viral when we talk about can babies read. It was sort of a strange study, but we're going to have a little fun with that next here on our Science Roundtable. We're going to take a very short break here and then come right back here with much more on our first ever Science Roundtable on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson, and on this Monday afternoon, you're listening to member-supported public radio. Welcome back here on this Monday afternoon to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson with the Science Roundtable. And we're talking about building healthy children with Dr. Jody Todd Manley, who is the clinical director at the Mount Hope Family Center, and she's a research associate in the Department of Psychology. The New York Times published a story about babies and learning to read, and I got a kick out of this story because my son will be 2 at the end of this month, and my wife and I were never addicted to milestones. But some parents, I do understand the focus on milestones. What I don't fully understand, Dr. Manley, is this notion that we must get ahead of the curve, and so we must get videos that will teach a child, a baby, to read before turning 2. So the research says babies before 2 are not learning to read. Were you surprised by that?
No, I wasn't, actually. But I think it underscores that parenting is a very challenging area for people, and a lot of times people don't know exactly what the best practices are or what they should be doing or shouldn't be doing with their children. And so a lot of parents kind of go for the materials that are out there that make great claims about doing amazing things, and parents often want to have their children succeed and are grasping at ways of doing that. So for me, one of the takes that I had when the link to that article was forwarded to me was that it's really important for babies and toddlers to have positive relationships with their parents. And that's actually an important foundational learning approach for little children, is to be able to talk with their parents and to make face-to-face contact with their parents, not be set in front of a video screen to learn some, you know, supposed pre-reading.
Yeah, and that bond and that one-on-one in your work and what you've experienced, most effective way just to get moving at a good pace for the child, right? I mean, I guess some parents are looking for something magical to get their kids ahead.
Well, and the magic is in that relationship. And some of the research that we've done at Mount Hope Family Center has been looking at secure attachment relationships, ways of supporting families in building those positive relationships. And I think, you know, if there's magic there, it's the power of love.
There was one other part of that study that I thought was interesting. They looked at 2 groups, you know, a pretty large study, kids who did not experience these videos and DVDs and learned a baby can learn to read by 2 kind of a thing, and the kids who did. The parents of the babies who were supposedly learning to read by 2, the babies were not learning to read by 2, probably because developmentally you can't push that rock up the hill far enough. They can't do it. But the parents thought they were. We can convince ourselves of very many things, can't we, Dr. Manley?
Well, and in fact, talking about that placebo effect that we were just
mentioning
before,
yeah.
You know, there's a lot of power in that. And sometimes parents may see what they wish they can achieve.
Yeah. And now your work has been, since 2007, you guys have been working on a program called Building Healthy Children. Tell us about how you're putting this research together and what you're looking at.
Okay. Well, our Building Healthy Children program is really a preventive program to help support young families, and specifically parents who gave birth to their first child under the age of 21. And we're trying to support those positive parent-child relationships between these young parents and their babies up to age 3. And we're also evaluating. We have several different evidence-based interventions that we're providing to parents, but we're evaluating whether that combination of interventions in partnership with the child's medical home can have a positive impact and can help reduce rates of child abuse and neglect, hopefully keep these children out of the child welfare system, and really help the families get on a positive start.
And started in 2007, is that right?
Mm-hmm.
So what kind of a body, what kind of a sample size have you built up so far?
We have over 500 families that have participated in the program at this point. And one of the things that we've been very committed to, and with the support of our funders, the Department of Human Services and the United Way, that we have felt that it was really a priority to look at what we're doing and to evaluate the work. And rather than just feeling good about it, of the work that we do, which we, of course, do feel good about what we're doing, but to really look and see whether there's evidence to support that.
Yeah, that's one of the great pleasures of real scientific research and real study is occasionally finding out that an idea needs modification or an idea is wrong. And so what I'm curious about is that if you started in 2007, are there any modifications to the interventions that you're using, or have you learned that, boy, this is really working, but this is not having the impact that we suspected?
Well, we're continuing to channel the information that we're learning to continue to improve the program as we go along. Within some parameters, we don't want to totally modify the program while we're evaluating it, because then we don't know what our data is showing us. But I think we do pay attention to lessons learned. We do talk with families about what their needs are. We also talk with our partners, and this is a collaborative effort, with the University of Rochester Departments of Pediatrics and Social Work, and with our funders. And so we continue to learn as we go. One of the things when the program was started, it was with the idea that this population that we're working with might not be a severely at-risk population. And in fact, as we've done the initial screenings and assessments with the families when they're coming into the program, we found that, in fact, there are very complex family needs, that there are a lot of depressive symptoms that our young moms are reporting. There's a lot of domestic violence in the relationships. There's a lot of family mobility as they're trying to establish stable living environments, and a lot of risks for the families, financial, community violence, and a lot of other challenges that these young families are facing.
When kids see violence in the household, even if it doesn't directly involve them, how much more likely are they to be, to have problems or to be violent themselves later in life?
Well, that's one of the other areas that we're working in, and we're members of the National Child Traumatic Stress Network. If I can get to Washington this afternoon, there's a national meeting of the Child Traumatic Stress Network in Washington. And I think that there's growing awareness of the impact of exposure to violence, of other types of trauma on children's development. And so some of the other areas that we conduct research in is looking at things like the interaction between one's environment and one's genetic makeup, and how exposure to violence and those types of traumatic stressors can actually change the way that genes are expressed. It can change the regulation of stress hormones. And to have that impact in developing children's bodies can have lifelong consequences.
All right. So let me wrap up on this portion of our discussion with Dr. Manley on this. You've probably got some children now who are what, 6-7 years old? If they've been in the, you've been able to sort of continue with the research for a while. So you're really starting to build a profile now that is much broader. And I suppose that's what is the great benefit of more long-term research.
Well, and that's some of what we've been doing in our work at Mount Hope Family Center over the decades that we've been in existence, is a lot of longitudinal research. We are currently conducting some studies now with some young adults and adults that we had worked with when they were young children. So we are looking at the longitudinal progression of their risks and their protective factors and what helps some kids be really resilient in the face of adversity.
It's our first ever Science Roundtable here on Connections, and we're going to do this every month and talk to professors and researchers and, from different disciplines and backgrounds. And our panelists today are from the University of Rochester. We want to talk in our last minutes of this hour about the effort to bring more people into the scientific community, or at least more interest in science. And I'd like to play a soundbite, if I could, to start this discussion, from Neil deGrasse Tyson. Now, Neil has said many times that he thinks that we are absolutely underserving the interest in science that kids have. He says, you know, we just accept the fact that some kids get into science, but other kids don't really like it, and, well, we just give up on it, or we belittle science. And he says, no, it is so inherent in us that we can cultivate it and we can do a much better job. So let's listen to what he says, and then we'll talk about it.
Every child is a scientist. And so when I think of science, I think of a truly human activity, something fundamental to our DNA, something that drives curiosity. They go together, the act of being curious and the act of wanting to do the experiment.
That's Neil deGrasse Tyson. Dr. Wendy Heinzelman, who is the Dean of Graduate Studies at the University of Rochester, you not only have a passion for science, but you have a passion for bringing more women into science. Why that specifically?
We have a problem, especially in engineering. I think a little bit more so than some of the sciences are not so bad, but in engineering in particular, there's what they call the leaky pipeline, where the number of girls who say they're interested in engineering and want to go into careers in engineering starts out low, but then drops off at the undergraduate level, at the graduate level, and then going on to research careers, it's very, very low. And so one of the goals I think we need to do as a nation is to increase the participation of all groups in science and engineering, because if you just have one particular viewpoint, you're missing out on a whole spectrum of experiences that can inform new discoveries, can inform new creativity, design solutions, and things like that. I mean, there's been tons of studies that show diversity in a group really helps you to find solutions, better solutions, faster coming to those conclusions. And right now we don't see near the diversity in education in those who are interested in science and engineering careers among our population of students as we see in the general population of the United States.
What kept you moving in the field that, as you said, very few women get into and then very even fewer stay with?
So my interest in engineering really started with my father, who was an electrical engineer, and I saw what he did and how much he loved what he did. And he got to basically go into work and solve problems. So he worked on speech recognition technology. So he was one of the first people to develop an automatic speech recognition system. And it was just a cool problem to work on. It's like a puzzle. You know, it's something that can be done. How well you do it and how creatively it's done may differ, but you know you can come up with a solution. And it was that excitement and that passion for going in and solving those problems that really got me interested. I always loved math. I loved the beauty of math and solving problems. I just thought it was a fun thing to do. And when I saw how much he loved what he did, I thought that would be a great thing to go into. So that really got me started and why I chose when I was an undergraduate to go into engineering. But then once I was there, just the faculty who inspired me with their love of the research and their love of what they did was really key. I don't think I had a female professor until I was my senior year. They had brought in their first female professor in the department. So it wasn't necessarily needing to see the role model of a woman doing this, but just people in the department were so excited about what they were doing that I loved what I was doing and decided I wanted to continue doing that and go on to graduate school.
Dr. Jody Todd-Manley is from a different background and does different kind of work, but I imagine it's just as important to you to send the message to young girls and girls as they become women in school that research, science, that kind of a discipline is something that should not be male-dominated.
Oh, I certainly agree. And in my field, we do have a lot more women in psychology. But even I was talking with one of our staff recently who has graduated from college, but she was thinking that she wanted to work with children and families in a kind of clinical way. But she's a research assistant on one of our projects, and she's fallen in love with research. And there's a way in which you can reach a child and family one-on-one, and that has an important impact. But if you can conduct studies, have publications, interface with people around the nation and the world that way, you may be able to actually reach a lot more people. And we've actually had some interesting partnerships with the engineering department and Mount Hope Family Center to develop new technologies to be able to study children and families and parent-child interactions in new ways. So there are a lot of possibilities out there, and I think it would be great if more girls and women continued to develop their curiosity, as the quote said, and pursue careers in science.
Poor Dr. Beckman sitting here, the male in the room. I apologize, Dr. Beckman. I mean, but I do want to ask you, especially having worked in this field for a number of years, are you comfortable with the way science and the scientific community is perceived in this country right now? Is there a stigma? Is the wrong word? I don't think science is stigmatized, but should it be more accepted and more celebrated?
My personal opinion is that the biggest problem is that the general public view science as something aloof and unapproachable. And yet they are every day interacting with it when they use their cell phones, when they use their latest laundry product. All of this is chemistry. They deal with it when they take the drugs that make them healthy and keep them healthy. But many of them view that as something that they cannot deal with. It's beyond them. And
they say someone else will take care of it.
Well, that they personally are don't feel capable enough. And I think the reason for that is really that we haven't done a good job in the very early education. Not so much once you get to college or even high school, but the earliest ones where you, I think the kids form on the basis of their own curiosity, they form their opinions about what turns them on, what interests them, and what drives them forward. And we too often don't have skilled people. That isn't to mean they don't have the students' best interests in mind, but they may not have the knowledge base or the appreciation for modern science to convey that to the kids. So I think upgrading the science education in the earliest stages probably will have the most beneficial effect. And one of them is to overcome this phobia against mathematics. Mm-hmm. We are losing ground in the world in terms of our capabilities based on the testing that's done of the various high school graduates around the world. We're losing ground primarily because we aren't really very proficient and don't seem to care about mathematics. Some of this arises from the fact that now no one has to do even arithmetic because they all have a calculator in hand, and no one has to exercise their brain in the way they used to, even to make change at a cash register.
But let me jump in and say, because I only got about 90 seconds left here, and Dr. Heintzelman, I wonder if STEM, does this come into play? Do you think that this is relevant here? We are almost out of time, but tell us briefly about what STEM education is and how U of R is involved.
So STEM education at the undergraduate level is very important, because once you get people at least expressing an interest in STEM, you want to keep that interest and you want to instill in them a love for what they're doing and an understanding of how important it is what they're doing. So at the U of R, we have a program called CERTL. We're part of the Center for the Integration of Research, Teaching, and Learning, where we're trying to work with graduate students and postdocs who are the future faculty to teach them how to work with students and how to think about teaching in a more intentional way so that we can embrace lots of different learning types of styles and make science exciting and accessible for undergraduate students.
Well, I think what Dr. Beckman, the point he just made, I've heard it made so many times, is that when we were growing up, I mean, the TI-81 was the thing. It was this amazing piece of equipment. And now, in our cell phones, we can do so much. But I'm going to make sure that my son grows up in a world where you don't just give up on learning mathematics just because you can do certain equations on your cell phone, because I think that not only handicaps his learning in mathematics, but it handicaps his curiosity. And I think what we've learned this hour is that there's so much that we're still curious about. So I hope you've enjoyed it. I've loved this first Science Roundtable. I didn't even get through listen to all these papers. I got through like about a third of the papers I had here, so if you'll come back again, we'll do it again at some point.
Great.
Dr. Jody Todd Manley, Dr. Bob Beckman, and Dr. Wendy Heintzelman from the University of Rochester in our first Science Roundtable. Maybe we need like a 2-hour science roundtable. Maybe that's the solution here. Thanks, everybody. Quick break here on Connections, and then we're going to focus on a couple of very different topics in our second hour. Stay with us.